Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined by two good friends. An unusual, not unusual, I guess, a less common guest, though you are fairly unusual, Matt. Matt Graham, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you, sir. How are you?
I'm very well. And David, you're also joining us on the line from LA?
Yes, I am.
Where it's a little late for you. I apologize about that, sir.
Oh, it's not a problem. I'm a kind of a night owl, so it works well for me.
So this week on the show, we're going to be talking about the Tom Hanks thriller, Angels and Demons. And I want to say something, if I can, just at the outset. The nature of the show is to occasionally, not funny, but, you know, sort of witty. And in the process of doing that, it's quite possible that I'm going to make a joke about something or other. And I just make it perfectly clear that anything that we refer to in today's recording that is about the Vatican or the Pope is certainly in no way about the actual Catholic Church, or for that matter, the actual Pope or any of the members of the clergy. In fact, it's important to note that the Vatican themselves were not involved in any way in the production, in allowing the filmmakers any access. So all the things which we'll discuss coming up, and one of the big aspects of the visual effects was recreating many parts of Vatican City because they were not allowed to film there. And it's important to say that because I want to be able to make comments about things, and I would hate anyone to think that I was trying to be disrespectful actually to the church. And of course, the Vatican is an unusual, or Vatican City is an incredibly unusual country, really, being the smallest country in the world. A mere 110 acres with a population of just 900. And this film opens with one of those 900 dying in what we turn out to be the central linchpin of a thriller drama. And this, this David, is actually meant to be played, I guess, as the sequel to The Da Vinci Code, though the book came out before it. So, David, if I can start with you, focusing on the film, just as we always do for a few minutes before we get into the visual effects, was this a film you enjoyed or not?
No. Short answer, no. It was a pretty darn bad movie, but it was adapted from a pretty darn bad book, so I guess they were faithful to the material, and that would be the one bonus that you could say as a positive. It was kind of badly written. The acting was fine, the direction was fine, visually I thought it was quite well done. It was just, you know, 45 scenes of people explaining information to other people who ought to know that already. And it kind of fell into the same situation that I think other adaptations got into, like Golden Compass or other books that have been made into movies that aren't necessarily visual effects films, but where there's a whole lot of information in the book that's very easy to get across on a page that is not easy to get across in a movie, but you need it in order to have the plot make sense, and so you have to have characters say it, and it just makes for a whole lot of exposition and a lot of boring filmmaking.
Yeah, it's really hard to obviously put someone's internal thoughts. You can read them in a book so easily, but I guess in a film you have to just invent a pretty looking character to stand next to the guy so, you know, they can just vocalize it.
Yeah, there's a big difference in something like Star Wars where, you know, it's like, oh, it's the Force, and the guy goes, well, what's the Force? And the character asking doesn't know. But, you know, you couldn't do that in the Star Wars prequels where the person goes, you know, Yoda turns to, Mace Windu and goes, what's the Force? And he goes, well, here's what the Force is, my little green friend, even though you know it already. you know, so unfortunately in a movie where everyone is smart and has knowledge, but the audience might not necessarily have that same knowledge, you have to explain a lot of things. And there's a lot of explaining of Catholic ceremonies and Catholic traditions and Catholic rituals that everyone in the movie, all the characters in the movie, know, but the audience probably didn't. So, I mean, what was it, like 3 or 4 times they had to explain the difference between white smoke and black smoke in selecting the Pope? So that was, like, I thought the big weakness of the film.
Yeah, I guess the thing for me is I definitely went in wanting to like this film because I love Ron Howard. I certainly loved Frost Nixon. I thought that was terrific. But there are so many of his films that I thought were really good. I loved A Beautiful Mind. I loved Apollo 13.
Cinderella Man.
Backdraft. There's like a lot of good. So Ransom. So now there are... Oh, and Parenthood. Oh, that was a good film. But anyway, there are some films I was less keen on that he'd done. Ed TV and stuff. But generally speaking, I find him to be a really interesting director. But of course... he's incredibly well known for having also been an actor. And so I find it interesting to watch when he has a film that allows an actor to act. And I saw that in Ransom, for example, where I think we saw some really good acting from Mel Gibson when he was kind of dealing with internal things. And I was hoping that's what we'd get here. I was hoping that we'd get a lot more great acting out of Tom Hanks, who I also quite like, from the sort of direction of Ron Howard. What I didn't find was that I got that. What I found as I got was sort of a Da Vinci Code crossed with National Treasure, and I didn't like National Treasure. But, hey, let's discuss the VFX for a second because it was a fairly large visual effects challenge that the guys were given. As I've already mentioned, they weren't allowed to film in the Vatican, Mons Vaticanus, to use the Latin. And... the thing about it is that we know those areas pretty well in terms of they're, you know, some of the world's most photographed, most iconic churches and places of religion. So when someone talks about St. Peter's Basilica, or when you talk about, you know, any of these major landmarks in the Vatican City area, you kind of expect to get some pretty grand kind of visions. And of course, they weren't able to do that. So they had to resort to both digital and visual effects and just doing some big stuff on backlots. And so, David, what did you think of the visual effects overall? It was done by a number of companies, but just in terms of the impression of the reconstructions of these famous places.
Overall, I thought it was pretty good. I thought it was kind of ironic because I don't know about you, but the second thing I ever built in computer graphics after a Chrome ball on a checkerboard floor and going, ooh, was I started to build a Roman temple with the, you know, the columns and the marble everywhere and that kind of stuff way back almost over 20 years ago now.
But, I think my first project when I was on work experience at an effects house was doing solid texturing and trying to use the SID graph notes on solid texturing to produce marble for above-mentioned columns. So I'm right with you on that one.
Good old Perlin noise. But the they were very well executed, but I thought, like, as I was after, you know, coming home from the film and reading up on it as we do, I thought it's what was most ironic thing about it is we have all this technology to create, you know, to recreate how light interacts in the real world in the computer, you know, global illumination and subsurface scattering and yada yada yada, and it makes for these really gorgeous, intricately lit backgrounds that are not having any kind of lighting effect on our actors. And I thought that kind of always pulled the actors out of it, no matter how well they were comped into the plate. There was a certain meatiness that wasn't there, that was there in, you know, not even only that you get in a on location, but that you'd get in a studio set that wasn't quite there.
Yeah, I found a lot of the matte paintings, the lighting was really static, especially when you're tracking around in the shot. Just seeing street lights just sit there like they're just painted on and no interaction was, that really stuck out for me.
Yeah.
Well, let's get specific. Let's start with antimatter. And, of course, I have a slight problem with that, given that they actually generate a millionth of a gram of the stuff and not several grams at a time. But leaving aside the, you know, being a geek enough to know that kind of thing, or having watched the making of, I guess the thing I'd say is that I thought the stuff they did at the particle accelerator was terrific. I mean, there was a lot of scenes there that I would have said, had I not read up, that they'd shot on location. Obviously, there were some sequences like flying in through the tubes down to where the actual antimatter was deposited in the vials that was a CG sequence. But, you know, other than that, I was happy, very, very happy in believing that the area outside the windows of the control rooms and stuff were in fact real. And I thought they did a phenomenally good job of putting that visual environment together. What about you, David?
Yeah, I really like that one. And I thought it was, it probably had to be one of the most challenging things to do artistically and technically, because it's a very clean environment and a lot of shiny, polished surfaces, right? So you have these chrome connectors, and you have these, perfectly painted pipes, and it's all, brand new construction, so it hasn't been there for a while. So it's clean, 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 technical looking. And in when you're doing computer graphics, getting stuff too clean is too easy. You always have to kind of grunge it up a little bit to make it look real and have any kind of oomph to it. So I'm sure they were trying to strike a very, very fine balance between, making it look real, as in making it look like the actual thing, and making it look real coming out of the computer, because the I'm sure if they made it look like the real Super Collider, that the computer graphics would look cheesy and fake. So they
Well, actually,
probably had a
I know what you're saying, and I totally agree with you. Having said that, though, I saw an interview, because they flew, basically. Not no, I didn't get to fly. Did you get flown?
No, I didn't get the
Yeah,
phone.
but
No,
they
we
flew a
didn't,
bunch
no.
of journalists to Switzerland, to the Large Particle Collider, and did a bunch of press junket interviews there. And so when you actually saw these, clearly shot by ENG camera crews, I'm telling you, the thing looked exactly the same as it did in the movie. It was remarkable. I mean, so much so that that's the point at which I started to go, oh, okay, you guys have really nailed this in terms of the look of the setup. I know what you're saying, like sometimes, clean, perfect, new particle colliders can look a bit CG even when you're standing right in front of them. But I mean, it really looked good. And I think that was work that was done by MPC in London, and full credit to them, because I thought, apart from that CG sequence flying through the pipes, Matt, did it feel like an artificial environment?
No, it felt good. You kind of were expecting it to be a bit of an artificial environment, because these days it's so easy just to throw up a green screen. And a lot of this film was done on green screen, all the interiors of the churches and stuff. So it's nice that they actually built a set.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as a general rule, I had no problem with that setup whatsoever. I mean, I understand the need to be a bit cinematic. Is that the cheat word we're using this week for how antimatter is, put together and stored, and you need a simple concept of it running out of its electromagnetic charges and dropping off. And though it's convenient that it did come with batteries.
Yes, and it's nice that it just stayed nice and stable. Most unstable thing on Earth, nice and stable with two
Nice and
magnets.
stable, and nice and sparkly,
Magnetic.
and emitting light from antimatter was an interesting concept. But hey, apart from that, I bought all of that, and so I was pretty comfortable with that.
Mike, it wasn't emitting light, it was emitting anti-dark.
Okay.
Of course.
Of course. How stupid of me. So full marks to MPC for, I think, some really good stuff there. And as I understand it, that was pretty much all done in Maya and RenderMan.
What I love about the little fly through shot where it flies through the walls there is CERN actually gave them the CAD files for the Super Collider to build it
That's cool.
technically accurate,
Because no
which
one's going to say, hey, look, I've got my own blueprints. Let's go and make another one.
yeah, that's what I was like, how much did they spend to build this? And then they're just like, oh yeah, you want the blueprints? Here you go.
Yeah, because there's something about building super colliders that makes me think you're not going to do that unless you're pretty darn serious.
I think they showed a lot of the plates for that stuff on the red as well, which was
Oh, really? I didn't know
interesting
that.
that they were mixing. Yeah, there's a really good mix of various capture devices all the way through the film.
I knew they shot VFX plates on the red
Yeah.
For this, but I didn't know that that was the some of that stuff. I thought that they'd done a lot of photogrammetry and reference stuff actually in Switzerland. Is that what you'd?
Yeah.
The other thing I'd like to call out from that sequence, which I noticed during the film, which I thought were really nice, were all the on-screen graphics that were done.
Gorgeous, weren't they?
Yeah, I thought they were really well done. So,
Yeah.
well done to the team there, because that's always kind of a hard thing to do, because you have to have them ready on the day rather than being able to, you do have the ability to plug them in afterwards, but that always costs extra money, and you never want to do it unless you have to. So, that was really well done, and I'm glad they didn't use the big touchscreen table to
There
that
was
seems to
no
be everywhere
Microsoft
nowadays.
sponsorship of this one.
Although
What film was that in where it was done recently. Sorry?
Quantum of not as good as the last one.
Quantum of Solace, right. Yeah, they suddenly used the table, which was pretty funny. But I think I'm really glad you pointed that out, because I've got to say, you think that it wouldn't be that hard to do a UI design that looks all techie and brilliant. And if you've ever thought that, sit down in Photoshop and try doing a still of the darn thing and have it look serious and not silly. And it's really, really hard.
The one thing that bugged me, though, was back in, was it the Swiss bunker underneath the Vatican, and they've got the monitors set up, and they still have fast forward and rewind buttons on non-linear, and you actually watch the thing scrub through. I thought, why do they have that? They should have like a nice little timeline, like Final Cut or something.
So all that happens in Switzerland, and then we get, of course, Professor Langdon, Robert Langdon, brought over, and I'm told, now you guys can email me and let me know on the Twitters whether this is correct or not, but I'm told that in the book, he actually uses a supersonic special Vatican papal jet that's an experimental jet that the Vatican just happens lying around to get there in record time. But in this one, I think there was a couple of those, actually, a couple of points where the book was even more outlandish than the film in terms of plot. I think also he went up in the helicopter at the end and used the papal windshield as his papal parachute.
See, I wanted to see that. That would have been anyway, classic filmmaking.
So obviously wound it back a bit. But now we get to Rome, and that's, of course, where most of the action starts. And I guess for me, if I was to be critical, the only building that I thought didn't hold up particularly well that I was really aware of massive green screen on was the Parthenon. They built a 9-meter kind of set of statues and a bunch of stuff, but for me there were shots in that area that just, I don't know, it looked like the keys had been sucked in too much, the old digital haircut, and it just didn't feel, whereas a bunch of the other churches and stuff I totally bought into when they had, and I now know that they were digitally reconstructed. Does anyone else find that? Matt, did you find the Parthenon on anything?
I found anywhere that they started using large, you know, crowd sims and stuff just seemed a bit washed out and didn't really sell for me.
Yeah. Wow, I thought the crowd sims were brilliant. You mean in the square? I thought that was just exceptionally good.
Some of the square ones were better than others, and yeah, definitely inside the Parthenon. It's just you've seen that shot so many times, a really high shot looking down at everyone seated. I don't know.
What about you, David?
Well, I think Matt is confusing the Parthenon with the Sistine Chapel.
He is, and I was just looking at that slide, actually. Oh, but no, that's right. We've called him out on it now. There is actually no seats in the Parthenon. But anyway.
Oh, there's so many churches.
Go on, David.
It's like you.
Let's embarrass the guest. No, go on, mate. What were you saying?
I just wanted to make sure we were all on the same base on
Parthenon's
what Parthenon's
one of the first buildings
about.
They walk into, and they discover they're in the wrong place, and they dash out, and it's around the first murder. And that's what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, it's a big circular building, but yeah, I'm with you now. There's one shot in that where there's a kind of a bald-looking guy who walks right at camera, and the matte line is so buzzed around his head with a gigantic bloom on it that I couldn't believe that somebody finaled that shot. That had to be a last-minute final.
That was that section, you know, I mean, to be critical for a second, that was the only section that I felt really bad about that in. Like many of the other churches and stuff, I was spectacularly impressed with what they managed to do, but that one didn't work for me. And I think we should point out for people that don't know that when we say they weren't allowed to photograph and film in there, then they really weren't allowed to photograph. They weren't allowed to even put down tripods to do HDRs and all the kind of normal stuff that that we're used to. They could act as tourists and go and just take handheld shots, but if any of you have ever tried bracketing HDRs and doing detailed work, you really want a tripod. So a lot of this work was a monumental effort in reconstructing these environments based on photogrammetry without the benefit of being able to control other crowds, other lighting issues, and certainly without being able to sort of whack down robotic tripods and stuff, which, you know, we talk about this, but Dineg was involved a lot in this stuff, and Dineg did phenomenally great work on the Batman series with reconstructions of Chicago and stuff, but that was a robotic HDR rig with all that went along with it. And of course the buildings tended to be much more architecturally clean aligned, non-gothic, non-stone detailed buildings, which of course lends themselves much more to that kind of reconstruction and camera mapping and stuff. So I thought on the whole, I mean, I jumped on the Parthenon, which I don't know who actually did that, but the stuff that I saw that Dineg did, in particular St. Peter's, I thought was great. And I'm surprised you commented on the crowds, because I thought the crowds, I mean, I looked at that when I was watching it and I said, that's got to all be crowd sims when they're moving in and out of the square and through the square. And that was, I thought, was really good work.
Yeah, well, they used a couple of different techniques. I mean, Dineg came up with a really cool system through Houdini to shoot live-action plates and then use them as cards, and they used that for most of them. And so, yeah, it, for me, that kind of real interaction was really cool. But, I don't know, just around the edges, it just seemed not to be as cool, especially that final shot coming over the big guy's shoulder, and then it quickly going to like a bokeh effect to hide the fact that maybe that shot wasn't holding up as well.
Yeah, I know they did use sprites in Houdini for the for some of that, and they also actually had some other actual, as you said, another technique was actual agent type. I'm going to say Massive style. It was not Massive; it was their own system. You're probably more familiar with it than either of us, David. What did you think of the crowd sims?
The crowd sims I thought were pretty darn spectacular. You know, it's one of those where the only reason I knew it was a crowd sim is because I knew it had to be a crowd sim, because they never would have done it any other way these days. You know, I kind of miss the days of I think the last great epic movie that had a crowd was Gandhi. You know, where he stands up there before a crowd of 80,000 people, and the way they did it is they got 80,000 people.
But how good does that look, though? I mean, I wish we really could just roll in 80,000 people whenever we needed a crowd shot.
But do we really think that if you'd had 80,000 extras in St. Peter's Square, it would have looked significantly or noticeably better?
Well, I don't think we're on a same kind of genre of film as Gandhi, and like, of course, it's, you know, a Dan Brown novel adaptation. You can kind of get away with, oh yeah, it's a crowd sim, but let's move on. It doesn't really help to
see. I'm really surprised with that, because I would have said the thing that I reckon worked best in this film, almost anything, even better than the buildings, is those crowds.
I like,
I just was really
more
impressed with them.
I was really impressed with the buildings.
What it kind of limits you to doing, though, is it does limit your photography, because what you get is you can do the, you know, you can do that shot, which I think is actually required of every single movie that takes place in Rome, of the guy walking out into the balcony, whether it's the Roman emperor, whether it's the Pope, whether it's whoever, you know, in the camera coming up and pushing over his shoulder to reveal the crowd or the square below.
Well, hang on, let me interrupt you there and say, if that's required for shooting in Rome, the crowd shot that is required is a line of crowd surging forward, be them in Middle Earth or across the square when they're let back in after the terrorist attack.
Getty Images should just have a stockpile of these.
Of large crowds as a line moving across in formation. Sorry, go on. What were you going to say, David?
Exactly. So you can do that shot or the big aerial, or you can do them, you know, running through the crowd with the camera right in front of their face, you know, with a couple of live-action featured extras around them. But what you can't do is you can't do that kind of middling shot where it's, you know, the camera racing through the crowd, you know, catching up with your actor, going past your actor to where they're headed to. You know, it kind of limits you to being either right with your actor or really wide on the crowd. You can't really you know, when you're doing a crowd sim, you can't really do a featured crowd sim, if you understand what I'm saying. You can't get, you can't do a mid shot on a crowd sim.
That can
limit you cinematography wise.
If they're soldiers in kind of uniform and helmets and stuff, you can get pretty darn close to them in a kind of battle formation. But I agree, like, it's dangerous. I mean, the sprite approach, I think, works really, really well. But I had a question for you, because you do so much coding and programming. It's my impression that if you had to pick a really good procedurally controllable way to tackle a sprite, that Houdini's the way to go right now. I mean, that's what they use. But was that what you'd use?
Oh, God, yes. If I had to do a crowd sim, it would be either put Houdini in front of me, put Massive in front of me, or put Vodka in front of me. because that's just the only way to do it. I mean, Houdini is... It's kind of the package that people forget about, but it's so fundamental to every single facility. I don't know a single facility that doesn't have it somewhere in their pipeline as the go-to tool for effects. And
I was going to say, for effects animation, it seems to be definitely the cornerstone of, you know, if you're going to do some really good volumetric stuff or that kind of stuff, then it also dovetails really, really well with RenderMan, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. They also have a fantastic internal renderer called Mantra that is doing some really nice stuff these days with volumetrics and fluid effects and that kind of stuff. That you know, and it their legacy goes all the way back to you know, the early 90s before Maya,
side effects
before
software.
Side effects and prisms.
Yeah, prisms. I remember prisms really well.
You know, I mean, back in the day, this is like the nostalgia show.
we used to use it for doing like big network idents, which back then, you know, big network idents were all, you know, 3D because that was considered pretty hip back then. But yeah, that's what we used to.
Yeah. But it used to be, you know, you'd model in Alias, you'd animate in Softimage, and you'd render in RenderMan. That was kind of what everyone always kind of lived by. But the thing that everyone always kind of forgot is, and you do your particles and prisms. You know, Houdini is a really solid package, and for anything where you have to do rules based, or you're doing some kind of simulation or something where you have to change things based not on making a I'm going to grab this object and move it over here, but kind of set up rules and that kind of thing, you really can't beat Houdini.
Yeah, I mean, Massive, of course, and let's not skip it. I mean, Massive is also completely built to feed into RenderMan. It's RIBS files. It's just you know, completely its baseline. But having said that, I think that if we do some digging, we'll find that DNEG's solution actually is kind of on par, or in some places, interestingly, better than what you can even do with Massive. And I don't want to dismiss Massive, because I think Massive is both excellent software, well written, and a cornerstone of crowd stuff. But it does seem like a number of the London houses have been developing their own. I think Framestore has their own crowd sim and stuff as well. And yet, I mean, it really, I just couldn't imagine doing that in Maya. It would just be, you know, we sort of think of animation, and a lot of the discussion happens around character animation, but procedural animation is absolutely vital to pulling off some of this stuff. I just think, you know, Houdini deserves a bunch more attention, actually.
Yeah. Actually, I wrote a crowd simulator many years ago that did run in Maya, that it was for Polar Express for the previz team that would previz out the crowds in Maya. And then, you know, the plan was that once the crowd placement was approved, that would import directly into Houdini. I don't know whether or not the effects team ever did pick up those layout files or not, or if they just went from scratch, but that was the plan. So having written a crowd simulation software in Maya, it's not fun.
Yeah, I mean,
Lots of vodka.
The vodka, yeah. Like the stuff at DNEG, I mean, is not just Houdini. They use their own, I think they use Squirt, their fluid dynamic solver, for doing a bunch of stuff with the antimatter particles and stuff. Which brings me to that explosion in the heavens, as it were, when the chopper goes up and there is an antimatter explosion up in the clouds, though beyond the visible, you know, eye line, because it is literally up in the clouds. Anyone want to... Matt, do you want to jump in on what you thought of that that effect?
I liked it.
Pretty.
Yeah, I thought it was really beautiful.
Biblical.
And it was, yeah. I love the colors you used as it finally dissipated and turned into a more organic kind of wonderment. But I thought it was really good. I thought, you know, the story behind that was kind of lame, with, you know, him falling down on the parachute and slamming against the roof. But
the papal parachute was where they kind of lost me. But
they should have just kept the camera, well, you know, virtual camera, just looking up at the sky, showing, you know, 5 minutes worth of pretty stuff rather than trying to stretch the story.
Yeah, I think that it was stretching my believability as to how long that process took, in the sense that I didn't kind of believe there was like an explosion on the ground ignites a lot of other material that kind of continues after the actual explosion goes on. But that's probably more me having done a lot of work with explosions recently and me pondering it. But in terms of looking biblical and impressive, I loved the layered nature of the sort of circular matte painting, or I guess CG environment upon which the team did for the clouds. What about you, David?
I concur on all points. I thought it was really cool looking up in the sky. I like the way it lingered. I like the way it kind of looked like something that came off the Hubble. But I did have a kind of problem with, not visually, but story-wise, with the shockwave that kind of, I loved actually kind of the shockwave effect that traveled out, from St. Peter's Square, from, you know, outward, that shockwave effect was kind of cool. My problem was with the fact that if it shattered all those windows and, even down in the, Swiss Guards, offices, you know, which they literally showed later on, all the glass breaking.
Yeah, I thought that as well, yeah.
How come it didn't blow out everyone's eardrums? how come it didn't break all the lenses and all the cameras? How come it, you know, it seemed to only break what was convenient to break, not what would have also all been broken.
Part of the awesome power of antimatter, non-glass fracturing.
I mean, you're absolutely right, and I thought it had gone one layer too hard when they did the Swiss Guard, because I was thinking the same thing. It's like we've sort of established the Swiss Guard is in a secure location, and it felt like it was down in the lower part of the buildings. And so I was like, well, you know, the top would be completely demolished for the bottom to be shaken like that, unless it was a ground-based quake, like an earthquake, where, you know, theoretically things could fall over and crash.
Don't tempt fate. I'm in LA right now, and we've had a couple over the past few days. So
I have noticed the Twitters of of that, and good luck with that whole fault line thing.
Let's not mention the E word here.
If you suddenly drop off the Skype recording, we hope that California's still there. The thing is, I don't think the audience as a whole would have cared about that. But I do think the audience would have cared about things like how good the chopper looked and stuff. And I thought the CG chopper, I'm sort of used to seeing, for example, earlier when the papal jet was flying into the Vatican. Obviously, there's going to be a CG plane. There's no way they'd have flying real planes into the low over the Vatican City like that. And the chopper as well, all of that hard body stuff is pretty much under control now. But it's normally still something that I find bugs me in terms of motion blur. And to a certain extent, I think the contrast ratio out the window of the chopper still bugged me a little. But did that bug anybody else? Did you guys like the CG chopper?
I hated the CG chopper when it came into land.
Right.
From memory, did the chopper come down and the camera rises over a cross and then camera pulls focus and the cross almost disappears for a faint outline because of the defocus? And that shot just completely pulled me out of the film.
David?
Yeah, I really had a problem with the opening establishing shot of the helicopter, and it wasn't because of the quality of the helicopter, the quality of the rendering. It was the camera move was such an impossible computer move of the camera that it kind of made it just so fake looking to me.
I kind of blotted out the chopper arriving because I could never quite understand why you needed a chopper at that point, because the whole of Vatican City, the whole darn thing is 44 hectares, right? 110 acres. And you're in the middle of it, right? So it's not like you had very far to go at the best of times. I couldn't quite understand where the chopper thing... Did I fall asleep? Did I miss something?
I think the idea there was the helicopter took him from the airport to the Pope.
Okay. Well, anyway, the taking off was what I was referring to and not minding. But now you mention it, I was too preoccupied with wondering where this chopper was coming from, and also just the logistics of trying to land in a crowded square and thinking about all the times I've been in choppers that, you know, you just don't do anything, even vaguely, like going near anything. Point taken. I think those impossible camera moves always work against us. Though, interestingly, this film, and I think it sort of partly started in Frost Nixon, did employ a more handheld camera style than we saw in, say, The Da Vinci Code. The Da Vinci Code was criticized as being too ethereal and too intellectual, and therefore this was much more basically the ticking time bomb chase. And while I have problems with, you know, plot points, just in terms of the cinematography for a second, which is sort of vaguely and closely related to VFX work. We've mentioned that camera move, that impossible camera move, and also the massive camera move that I think you mentioned, David, on the crowd. But what about the general look and feel as they were running across rooftops and the general feel of the camera work?
Yeah, I didn't mind it. I thought it was all good.
David?
Overall, it was pretty good. It seemed to have... the one thing I kind of didn't like is the fact that when they were out in the streets, actually on location in Rome, because they were able to shoot on the streets of Rome, just not in anything owned by the church, it did have that kind of handheld feel. But as soon as they got into the studio for a lot of the green screen work, it was like, okay, break out the Technocrane, and there's a lot of big... camera swooping through the air, coming down, up over actors, turning around, coming down behind them to reveal, beautiful Bernini sculptures and that kind of stuff. And it was a kind of A versus B camera movement.
Yeah,
style.
Definitely. I mean, it's got to be hard to come up with something new every time you're going into half a dozen green screen churches. Okay, what are we going to do here? Let's go up and down. Next one, we'll do the other way around.
Yeah, and I'm sure at some point the visual effects supervisor stepped in and said, if we don't do the handheld on some of these shots where we have to track every single pixel because we're adding in a background, you can knock $4,000 off every shot. I'm sure that probably came into it a little bit. I'm not saying it did. I can't say for sure, but if I was a visual effects supervisor on the film and they said, "What's cheaper, handheld or a dolly move?" Obviously the dolly move is going to be a lot cheaper.
Yeah, I mean, if we are right in thinking that some of that stuff was shot on the red as well because it was VFX plate work, in fairness, you'd want to be fairly careful with the rolling shutter. You get too kinetic and you start to have play coming in on the rolling shutter. Now, there's been some work on that from people like the Foundry and stuff to produce anti-rolling shutter, effectively almost optical flow adjusters to take that out. But the red holds up pretty well in handheld stuff, unless you start getting into some really kind of jerky camera moves, and then you can actually have a heck of a time tracking that stuff. So I don't know, again, which sequences were shot with the red, but any CMOS camera like that is going to have some issues, and that may have also played into their technical decisions to be slightly less adventurous. Though you're probably right, it's probably a bit more just you've got this big virtual set, let's do swooping shots to show it off. What do we think about the attack that was the burning at the stake, effectively? Because that was a fairly detailed, in-the-flames kind of sequence. And I was having a look at that, thinking how I would have done it if I'd seen the script. If you'd been given that, David, do you think they, that script, I mean, do you think the solutions they came up with worked on screen?
They did cinematically. I actually really liked the scene because I can't remember the actor, the guy who looked like Guy Pearce, the bad guy, the assassin for hire.
The ethical assassin for hire who won't kill unless he's paid for.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm with you. Yep.
The way he just kind of busted loose with being a badass in that scene was pretty damn cool. But I found myself rooting for the bad guy, but.
He was cool until he hopped in a car and blew up, which you just...
Yeah.
No one in the cinema flinched at because we're like, look out behind you. Bang, there we go. Okay.
Mm. Yeah.
That rooftop they were running along was all virtual, by the way.
I know. That was very cool. I was impressed
by
that.
Okay, but let's get back to you, David. Yes? So, cinematically?
Cinematically, I would have liked to see a lot more smoke, a lot more kind of heat shimmer kind of going on.
It was pretty isolated.
I must say, I hadn't thought of that until you mentioned it, but even at my house, in my fireplace, if I have like a tiny fire, the amount of smoke that comes off that, if you'd actually had that amount of stuff burning, there would have been no way to see in that church.
Yeah, I was impressed that all the ancient old wood pews and stuff weren't caught alight by the fire.
I do like the double... it's an old kind of George Miller trick. Like you have the threat of the guy burning, and then there's the threat of the guy killing the guys, rescuing the guy being threatened. And then there's the threat of Tom Hanks falling in the fire because he's climbing up this thing that you know is going to be in trouble. And you kind of get multiple threats from different angles. And then just, having the guys turn up and buying him a bit of time under the altar while the assassin dealt with the two blue shirt Imperial Stormtrooper / Star Trek security men who walked in at the end. I thought it was good. I thought, you know, I like that kind of constructed scene. In fact, I must admit, I like anything where there's a cleverness to the filmmaking. And I kind of missed it in the rest of the film, that there wasn't more inventiveness in terms of the kind of A to B to C construction of it. I love that kind of really detailed cinematic production design that really gets you thinking, man, somebody thought this through. And you start pondering, like, what would you, you know, what came first, the ending or the, did they write themselves into a corner and solve it? You know what I mean? Like, there's an old serial in the days they had serial at the cinemas where there was this guy trapped on a, you know, every week they had a cliffhanger, yeah? And every, like, I think it was actually every week, it was before TV. And then he was pinned on a tree with a snake coming at him, hadn't been injected with poison, with a fire on the edge of a cliff, with spiders and snakes, no way out, no one knew where he was, and he was gagged, right? And that was the cliffhanger. And the next week you come back, apparently this is really famous, to like, well, how did he get out of it, right? Because he's like, if he gets out of the thing and the snake's going to eat, and then he got the poison, and it just had, after he escaped, it's just like, oh, come on. Like, you can write your... So, go on.
It's like the end of Desperado, right? Where it's you're expecting this, you know, he's a killer gunfighter for the whole movie. And then, you know, there's a little, you know, he's talking with the arch nemesis, and then it flashes to white, and they're walking down the road after having won the battle. And you're like, come on, I want my money back.
There'll be a prequel at some stage.
I think if you can be really inventive and come up with some stuff that you kind of go, okay, that was, I did not so much even that I didn't see it coming, like it's a surprise, but it's an inventive, you know, things that you had kind of slightly discounted were all in play, and things that you thought were just incidental were actually really important. And when that really happens, it's great.
Yeah, but there's a way to do it in the serial or something like that. But, you know, imagine if at the end of Star Wars they were flying towards the Death Star and then it ended, and then they're on Hoth going, wow, wasn't it awesome how we blew up the Death Star?
Yeah, that was cool. that's twice you've related angels and demons to Star Wars in one show, and that's quite enough, I think. So I'm going to wrap it up there and say congratulations to all the visual effects houses that worked on that. Actually, we probably should flag who some of those were, because we've only mentioned a couple of them.
CIS did some amazing stuff.
If we could, before we do our congratulations to the houses, there's one shot in there that I just wanted to call out as just being spectacular.
Yeah.
The opening sequence where it's a tight close-up on the fisherman ring.
Oh, yeah.
That ring is all CG, and it's sitting up there on the screen, you know, 60 feet tall, and looks completely and utterly photoreal.
Yeah, that
and,
was great.
As if it was a macro lens on a killer camera. Just getting every little detail of it, and whoever modeled that, well done, because that was a really, really well done thing. Whoever
and
shaded
it was a
it,
great
lit
way
it.
To open the film as well. You know, it
absolutely
said so much. I thought it was really good. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I had completely forgotten that was really impressive. So other than NPC and DNEG, and you mentioned
CIS Vancouver did an awful lot of shots,
and the Senate.
And the Senate, they did some as well. It's interesting, they actually did an awful lot of shots that weren't even in the film. I mean,
sorry?
Well, there was a total of 1,157 VFX shots in the film, but only 917 actually got used in the final cut, with DNEG taking over 359 of those shots, CIS Vancouver 240, MPC with 201. And
CSI
then the Senate-
Vancouver is what used to be Rainmaker, right?
Yeah, it is. They used to be Rainmaker, and what's really interesting is their visual effects supervisor on the film kind of was reading the tea leaves, as it were, when he read the books, and he actually went out to Rome even before the Da Vinci Code came out to take very organized photos of all these churches, because he was thinking, they're not going to let us back in these churches once this movie comes out. He actually did some pretty extensive research on it, but because the quality of the cameras was not so much, they kind of had to throw all that out, but they did use it in their, they hadn't even been awarded the film, but they wanted to, you know, use it in their bidding towards the film, and show that they were pretty enthusiastic about doing the project. So I thought that was pretty cool.
They used a really good technique of they used three Canon 1DS Mark II cameras, and which gave them great low light for inside the churches and stuff. But then they used a film camera as well, using the exact same stock as the rest of the main unit. And then they scanned that film, and that allowed them to have the latitude and the HDRs, which I thought was a really cool technique.
Oh, so they were getting the latitude by shooting on film.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. hey, you no, really, I hadn't. I'm not making it up. I mean, it was a good idea, right? You can scan and get more out of the film. Hey, so, and of course, you don't have to worry about things moving. I cut you off, though, when you were running the numbers. Did you finish?
I can't remember.
So, because you just mentioned CSI, and I was...
Okay, yeah, and okay. MPC did 201 shots. The Senate did 196, and they also had their own in-house production unit, which did the other 161 shots.
Cool. Well, thank you for that. Wow, you've done your homework. And speaking of homework, David...
You know, I was just thinking here before we go, because we were talking about doing the research photos. I'm wondering, and talking about Red doing plates, I'm wondering when we are going to reach a point where you have these high-res digital cameras that people will be able to go out and do, plate capture and incredible research capture without anyone knowing it. You know, I'm sure you could stand in the middle of the Parthenon with a Red camera and, you know, do two pirouettes and get some pretty nice, you know, enough information to do a decent camera projection textures.
Yeah, but I mean, a Red camera is still quite bulky. Go to a Scarlett or Epic, the next generation, or even for that matter, perhaps a Canon Mark III 5D kind of. I don't know if the Mark II is there quite, because the video mode is only 1920 by 1080, but certainly once you have a stills camera that can actually look like a stills camera and actually record the stuff that we want, it's going to be pretty hard. I've got to say, when we went up the London Eye to do stuff for Dwarf, they were like, they saw us going in and they saw we had a tripod, and they were like, well, you can't take a tripod up there. And I'm like, why? And they go, you can't take photos that are, you know, professional. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I just want to take some photos. And they were like, yeah, no, you can take photos, just can't take them with a tripod. And I'm like, why? I mean, I know why, but I mean, it was just like, it was a daft rule, right? But it was just, they had the same problem on this, right? This, you can take as many Nikon, Canon, really good photos. You just can't put a tripod down or a monopod, because that suddenly deems to be professional photographers. And that line is going to be really hard to police, David, as you get, these smaller, basically, it looks like a stills camera, film cameras.
Exactly. Is this something I thought about as we were sitting here talking?
I mean, let's face it. I'm betting all the money in my pocket against all the money in your pocket that both you and I are going to be interested in getting some of those Scarlett and Epics when they come out. So, for exactly that reason.
Yeah, this date is somewhere in the far-flung future.
So, do you want to thank our research team?
Oh, absolutely. All of our research is done by the wonderful Laurie Apthorpe, who is putting together amazing amounts of information for us every single week. And the VFX show is produced by the wonderful Kristen Martin. And they do wonderful work behind the scenes. So thank you very much. And
Kristen's going to be on a show coming up in a few weeks' time, actually, when we do one of our retro shows, which have proved very popular. Sorry, I cut you off. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, you can follow us on Twitter at VFX Show and be informed of when our shows are coming out.
And you're personally on the Twitters as what?
I am as David Strapinis, all one word.
And is that the best place to follow you, or is your blog getting more active?
Yeah, pretty much. As I'm rolling off my current job, I'll be doing some new stuff. And
I did enjoy your blog posting about Neely being attacked while helping a damsel in distress.
I had quite the weekend, because I that happened on Saturday, and then we got hit with a 5.0 earthquake on the following evening, and just. California is an interesting place sometimes.
You can find me on the Twitters as Mike Seymour, or on the tubes over at fxguide.com. Now, Matt is like younger than me. I'll admit it. I'll be public and say this. He is not quite of my generation. And as a consequence, he's not a Twitterer, which I think
I'm
is
just
actually,
not one of them Twitterers. What can I say?
But
I'm
you
sorry.
Are a Facebooker.
I'm a Facebooker. I'm not a MySpacer. I'm just a Facebooker, no Twitterer.
So where are you on face space?
I don't know. You just look up Matt Graham and then I appear magically.
Okay. We want to thank everyone for listening. We appreciate you guys supporting us. We'd love getting questions and stuff sent through, and you know, we really do try and read everything, and it's tremendously interesting to us to hear from you guys. So feel free to email us if you want to have some, or as I say, post on any of the common, largely exploited in the popular press methods of communicating with your peeps. Did I get that right, Matt?
Unless it's about piracy.
Matt's been trying to educate me on how to be like slightly less stilted in my language.
You're so hip to the jiggity jive, I tell you.
Okay. Well, David, thank you so much, sir.
Well, thank you.
And I'm sorry we didn't get you on last week for Star Trek, but...
I'll just say I freaking love that movie.
Yeah, and I knew you would, sir. I knew you would. Okay, until next time, guys. Thanks so much. See you.
Thanks, guys.